Peace be unto you. This is our Holden greeting. Peace be unto you. I plan to talk about fundamentals of mono and stereo, which means that I will try to explain to you how sound, how very complex sound, speech and orchestra, is put on a record, and particularly during the last 20 years, how it is put on binaurally, that is, that we have a stereo record where we have the feeling of live music coming from two speakers, from two points of the room, and so that it sounds like a live orchestra. Now, I wrote some short notes earlier this year, and my opening sentence was, a tone is characterized by two independent variables, pitch and loudness. And I believe that if I start that way, I will turn most of you off. So I will start in a different way, a way which probably interests you more, and which will explain what I mean by two independent variables. We go to a supermarket and we are going to buy some eggs. We are going to the dairy counter and we buy eggs, a dozen of eggs. And there are boxes of eggs, and these eggs are graded according to size. We have pullet eggs, we have medium-sized eggs, we have large eggs, we have extra-large eggs, and we have jumbo eggs. Yeah? Now, this is grading to size. And I can draw a line here and plot here pullet, and here I put medium, and here I put on large, and here I put on extra-large, and here I put on jumbo, yeah? Okay, so this is size. And this is simply what I call an independent variable. You go into the store, you are in no way constrained to pick one, you have your choice, it's an independent variable, you pick a certain size, say you pick large. But now something happens. You have to pay. So the pay is a dependent variable. The pay depends on the size. Here I make a dollar sign, and it may start with, better you help me ladies, what, 38 cents or 40 cents, I don't know, and then it is 45 cents, and then it is maybe 48, 49 cents, people like the 9 now, and then it becomes 55 cents, and it becomes 60 cents. So here, we can, if you wish, we can draw a line, which is the function of price versus size. With the size, the price goes off, yeah? So this is then the dependent variable. That's the independent variable. And this is the dependent variable. Now, we have another dependent variable. Namely, the amount of eggs, of egg substance, of white and yolk, which you get. With a pullet, you may get, here we have a different scale. Now here's the ounces over there. That's the dollar scale, and you can put here an ounce scale if you wish. And with pullet, you might get so and so many ounces. With medium, so and so many. With large, maybe so and so much. With extra large, so and so much. And with jumbo, so and so much. So you see, we have a second depending variable. And this depending variable, as a matter of fact, is a rule steeper than the price variable. And as a consequence, at least according to what I think, it is more profitable to buy large eggs, because while the price is somewhat higher than for small eggs, the volume which you get is considerably larger. So that's a better buy. So you see, you have two dependent variables, namely the price and the volume of the egg, depending on the size, which can be the diameter of the small axis or so, whatever you want to define it, mathematic terms. So that's an example of an independent variable and dependent variable. Just for fun, we can stick a little bit longer to the eggs, and we can take another independent variable. And this independent variable may be color. We may start with a pure white color, and then we may go through yellow, and we wind up by brown. As far as I know, this makes no difference either to price, nor to size, nor to taste. So it is an independent variable. You can pick a yellow egg if you wish, but to me, I don't know. Maybe you ladies can correct me. Whether you have a yellow egg or a white egg or a brown egg, this makes no difference. You see, you don't pay any difference. You don't pay any difference in price, and you don't have any difference in weight. So this is an independent variable, and that's just the end of it. I hope that's correct. I don't know. Now we can take another independent variable. That's time. See, I just want to familiarize with these things that you do not recoil even before I finish my first sentence. Here we take time. And we start out with the time when the egg is laid. Here it drops down. Then within the next hour or so, the fellow comes, picks it up, brings it to the shed that is washed and graded and packed, and maybe the next day it is in the store here. That's zero, and here's one day. And now it is in the store. I don't know, 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Now, during this time, when these eggs are on display, the price may vary. It may start, let's say we take a large scale, a large egg, and it starts with 50 cents. Now, the law of supply and demand will then dictate that the price after a few days just drops down a bit, because in all the supermarkets the price goes down, there's more supply than the demand, so the price stays here. And then there's a general increase in price, maybe a little bit more, then it goes this way. And then the price will stay put for quite some time. When you reach 3 weeks, then comes the critical period, then the eggs are getting pretty old. And so the supermarket decides to put on a sale. You see, when you get things for sale, usually they are stuck at the point of getting fishy. I don't know, I found that out. But then the price drops down because of age. And then all the stuff is being sold, and that's the end of it. So you see here, well, once at this low price, maybe it's the lower. So now you see, we have another function. We have time is the independent variable, and the dependent variable is now, again, dollars. You see? Rightfully speaking, if you want to be very finicky, I would say these are not variations with times. These are variations which come about by other laws, economic laws, depreciation of the currency, supply and demand, but this is definitely a function of time. If the eggs get old, then the price obviously will drop, otherwise people won't buy. So I think you have now an appreciation of what I mean with the independent variable, an independent variable. And now after this little introductory diversion, I want to come back to my sound business, and I say that sound, one single tone, one single sustained tone, is characterized by two independent variables, namely pitch and loudness. The height of the tone is pitch, and the volume, that's loudness. I don't think there's anything else which characterizes one single tone. Now I can show that graphically. I can draw here time as a line, and I draw a wave. And I draw several waves. This would be a medium-sized tone of, which is very low. This is time. You will see in a moment what I'm writing at. When this tone is soft, low tone. If the tone is soft, then we can draw it with the same wavelength, but it is lower. The amplitudes, as we call it, that is the heights, are lower. So that's a soft tone. But low tone. If the tone is loud, then we have a large amplitude, but still we have the same wavelength. Now, let's take a high tone. A high tone has many vibrations. So a high tone would look like this. This would be beep. And if the tone is soft, it would be this. Beep. And if the tone is loud, it would be this. Beep. This is clear? This is clear. It's very important that you get these concepts straight. A low tone has a long wavelength, and if it is louder and louder and louder, it gets higher and higher and higher. And if it's a soft tone, then the amplitudes get smaller and smaller and smaller. But the wavelength is the same because the pitch does not change. So the loudness is associated with the height of the wave. as the pitch is associated with wavelengths. Once more, here we have a high pitched tone, so we have short wavelengths, many of these oscillations, and if it is a medium tone, it's medium height, if it is a soft tone, it's a little low, and if it's a loud peep, then it is high. Okay, if you have understood, I gave you some examples now, and you tell me what it is. I think I have to get a little water here on this contraption. I have great fun doing that, and I hope you have fun too. And I entertain you a little bit. We have talked about one tone. Now let's take two tones. We can superimpose that, naturally. We can whistle two, not I with my mouth, but two fellows, each has a flute and each plays a different tone. You see, we have then two tones which impinge upon our ear simultaneously or upon the microphone. Now what's this look? Now let's be drawing. To which is superposed a rather piano, rather low strength, low pitched tone. You see that? And we get this type of pattern. I have to show, wait a minute, I have to draw it a little bit more accurate. We have a wave which looks like this, you see? Here are always the tips, you see? The tips are, here the tips are higher, here the tips are highest, here they are lower. You see? The tips go to what is called an envelope. And here too, you see, I should not exaggerate that. So. This line would not show up. It would look like this, you see. But the peaks would follow what you call a sine wave. The peaks would go up and down. The peaks would go up and down, see? So that's the way it is. This is a high-pitched tone of fairly high strength, high amplitude, to which is superposed then a low strength, low tone. Now, just for the heck of it, we can turn the picture around. We want to make, say, a... Just a minute. So. Well, let's see. Now we want to have a what? a low pitched tone. You may even make it crescendo. It'll be real fancy. And for those who have not worked in this, I think it is necessary that you get a little feel for that, and therefore I go rather slowly with these first fundamental concepts. So we have a crescendo, an increasing loudness, low pitched tone. And now we superpose to this a very soft high tone whistle. So what we then get is this. Now again, this line which I drew first disappears, you see? And what remains is this picture, you see. This picture is a tone which is crescendo, low crescendo tone, and superposed to that is a high tone of constant height, of constant amplitude. So there's a constant high tone superposed to an increasing low tone. Now, next step. I think you, pardon me a second, then. No, maybe I get one that's a little bit more moist here. Yeah. Then we have an orchestra. We don't have two sounds, but we have many sounds. But in principle, we have the same thing. We have what we call a superposition of the different tones. And we get that in quite a complex tone pattern, much more complex as what we have shown. Now, I want to tell you about the number of vibrations which I have drawn here. If we have this line representing time, then a low frequency vibration, a very, very soft tone, at the limit of hearing, very deep organ tone, will maybe 30 vibrations per sentence, maybe 20. That's about 16 is about the limit which men will hear. When you go below 16, you don't hear it. You have a feeling of vibration, a physical feeling of vibration, but you don't hear a tone. So 40, 50 it starts, and then it goes through 500,000, these are very nice medium range sounds, and when you come to 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, you come to very high tones. When you reach 10,000, 12,000, then you reach the limit of hearing. And the interesting thing is that newborn children and young kids hear higher than older people. So the upper limit of hearing, the ability to hear very high sounds decreases with age. So when you are born, you may hear maybe to 12,000, vibrations per second, and then during your lifetime you decreases to maybe 8,000. I have checked quite recently, my hearing goes up to 8,000, which is still perfectly okay. I hear violin sounds really sounding like violin tones and not like flute, so I hear all these high frequencies. There are sounds which go beyond the limit of hearing. Obviously, you can produce 15,000 or 20,000. You won't hear it. Nobody will hear it. No human being will hear it, but a dog will hear it. And the bat will hear it. The dog can be called by what we call a supersonic whistle. You whistle with a whistle and no human being will hear it. For instance, in the middle of the night, if you don't want to awake your neighbors, but you want to alert your dog, you can have whistles which whistle a supersonic sound, which I think is rather interesting. Now, the question is now, how are such sounds... No, I want to say one thing more. We have here now again these two independent variables, pitch and loudness, which I started out, are now represented by two things, the pitch by the frequency of your wave. That is a function of time, yeah? This is time. And the loudness by the height. See, large amplitude, large height gives a loud tone, small gives a small tone, and high frequency, high, low frequency, low tone. All right. Now, if we will now take a stylus in a recording studio, a stylus is a diamond which cuts into a master disc made out of acetone or something like that, blank, you see, absolutely smooth. And then there is a diamond needle which cuts into this disc, and it is driven electromagnetically or electrostatically, which doesn't interest us. It is driven by some mechanism, so it cuts into the disc. Now, this stylus then can do the following thing. Number one, if there is no sound at all, it will cut a smooth groove. A smooth groove which goes in a big spiral, as you know, of course, from the outside to the inside, and on an LP, long playing record of 33 RPM, 33 revolutions per minute, such record can play 25 minutes or so, you see. That's a very great improvement compared to the old 78s, which played only 5 minutes. So the stylus then moves around in this spiral, a perfectly smooth spiral. If you would look under a microscope, fairly powerful microscope. On such a record, you will see just a small groove, just a small triangular groove put into this master disc. Now we have a sound. And now the stylus starts to wiggle. And it wiggles the following way. If there is a high-pitched sound, it will wiggle sideways at a high speed, very high speed. If the sound is a high-pitched sound, say it wiggles, 5,000 times a second. Now that's a pretty high frequency, you see, but the mass of the thing is so low that it can very well do it. It wiggles 5,000 times back and forth, and as a consequence, it cuts sideways these indentations into the groove, you see. Now, if the sound is low-pitched, say, 50, very low-pitched, now, of course, then there will be wiggles cut into the groove, which are much longer, you see, because we have a lower frequency. Now, if the sound is loud, these wiggles will go quite a bit to the left and to the right of the middle of the groove. Now, let me draw it this way. This is the bottom of the groove. These are the two sides of the groove. I can show you cross-section maybe. You see, here's the surface of the record. You see, this is the groove. You see, that's the center line of the groove. Now, if there is a low frequency, the groove may look like this. You see, we get wiggles. If there is a low frequency which is loud, now then we may get a groove which looks like this, you see? It is exactly what I have drawn before, you see? And if there's a high frequency, now then we have a very quick following in the wiggles, and if it is a loud high sound, now we have, of course, large wiggles here. And if you take such record or make from this master record, then you press them in by some ways, which I don't want to go into, your discs which you buy in the store, which are a copy, a faithful copy of this original master disc. And if you have now a pickup in your record player, this pickup will follow these grooves. And all the irregularities of the grooves which have been cut into it by the stylus. If the grooves have variations which are slow, you will get a low tone. If the variations are very fast, you get a high tone. If the variations are wide swing, you see, then you get a loud tone. If they are just a little bit, you have a soft tone. You have two independent variables, namely the pitch, which is given by the frequency with which these wiggles are cut in, and loudness, which is given by the amount with which the stylus has cut into the groove, and consequently the playback stylus of your machine then follows this thing and it makes a wide elongation to the left and to the right. That gives a loud tone. So again, these two independent variables, pitch and loudness, are now, if I may use this beautiful word, encoded into your record. And when you play it back, you get the music or the whatever it is, one tone or two tones or a whole orchestra reproduced in proper pitch and proper loudness. Now, you see that the stylus moves in a plane, in the horizontal plane. The record lies horizontally on your turntable, you see, and now it goes only to the left and to the right. You see, the record under it is driven by the motor. It goes this way. This gives the time element, you see, and the stylus moves sideways, either it moves slowly, which is 50 times a second or 30 times a second sideways, or it goes fast sideways, 5,000, 10,000 times, or it goes just a tiny little bit and then it's soft, or it goes more than it is loud, but it always goes sideways. So we have the one direction in which the thing moves. The stylus has only the the ability to move in the horizontal plane. This is clear, at right angles to the movement of the groove. The groove goes underneath this way, and the stylus moves at right angle to the groove. I assume that the groove is straight at this point, actually, across the circle, it's spiral, you see. But if this is the groove, you see, then the stylus moves this way, inside our pickup hand, you see, to follow these wiggles. And this is one-hour recording. That is the recording as we had it until 1948, I think, when the stereo came into being. Now, I want to say something else. If we have a picture like this, take anything. So that's here slow and loud, and here this soft and high, and so on. Isn't it true that we could completely eliminate half of that? Because this half is the mirror of this. So if we would erase it, we still would know pretty well what to do. We just we can reconstitute, so to speak, the lower half just by mirroring the upper half and putting it on. So this half would give us all the information we need in principle to reproduce it. So I would say that we have twice as much information encoded in a monaural recording than is necessary. That's an important point to keep in mind. And now we come to stereo. And the thing which is really intriguing to me is that you can have two channels, which are fed by two microphones on the stage, one to the left, one to the right, or by two microphones in front of an orchestra, a large symphony orchestra, where on the right side are the celli and the string bass, and in the back there are the trombones and the tuba and the trumpets, you see. And on the left side, where you have the left microphone, there are the violins, and in the back is the timpani, you see, and the drum, the kettle drum, you see, that's the way in symphony orchestra is usually arranged. So when you have a stereo recording and you have a nice room and you have your stereo loudspeakers, your two loudspeakers placed left and right of your room, and you sit right in front of it and you have a symphony, maybe you hear bang, you see the bang comes from this corner where the big drum is. And if you hear beautiful celli music, you hear it from your right speaker, from your right loudspeaker coming, so you have the complete impression of live stereo. And the intriguing question is, how is it possible to get a stereo music from one disc, not from two discs? And I may tell you that there was quite some fooling around to have not two discs, but to have two independent channels record on one disc with two pickups and so on. Of course, this didn't work. And so finally, breakthrough came that it is possible to record two channels on one disc with one groove and to pick it up with one stylus and still get two channels. Now this is, I think, very intriguing, at least to me. And I will tell you how this is done. And we talk now about one channel, say left channel. No, wait, let me just get my notes that I don't mix these things up. With the right channel. Let's start with the right channel. And there's one system which is now generally used called the Westrex system. And then we have a stylus which moves while the recording is cut, while the master is cut. This is the surface of the flank. Yeah? This is the stylus, the cutting stylus, which cuts the groove. And the right channel will then move only in the 45 degree direction. That is, this stylus can only move in this direction. It cannot go this way, it cannot go that way. The stylus can only move in this direction, 45 degrees. It's half a right angle. If you have right channel, if we have a low tone, now from all I have told you, then it will cut a groove into the right side wall at a low speed, 50 times a second, 100 times a second. And if it records a high sound, it will put in enormous amount of small annotation, 10,000, 12,000 annotations per second, but always in the right side. If the tone is soft, it will cut only a little bit into it. It will dig in a little bit. Low speed, low tone, or high speed, many times high tone, but it will dig in only a little bit. If it is a loud tone, the stylus will dig in deep, either many times per second, that's a high tone, or not so many times a second, then we have a lower tone. But it will always only dig into the right side, because it is constrained to move in this way. And in this way, our two independent variables, namely pitch and loudness, are encoded into the right side of the groove. We have all we need. We have the pitch, as exemplified by the frequency with which these little indentations follow each other. We have the loudness, as exemplified by the depth with which these indentations are cut, but we have it all cut only into the right side. And if we have the left channel, obviously we have the stylus moving to the left and encoding the left-hand channel information into the left side of the groove. Now the right channel is fed by the right-hand microphone which stands in front of the celli and basses and the brass, and the left channel is fed by the microphone which stands in front of the violins and the drums, you see? So we have actually these two different sound characters encoded into one groove, namely the right channel into the right side of the groove, the left channel into the left side of the groove. I think that's a very charming and tricky and neat thing. And now, if we play back, that is, if we buy the record, again, as present, and we have a stereo pickup. This stereo pickup is able to move not only sideways, as an ordinary monaural record, which has nothing else to do but to move sideways. The record address moves one way, and the needle moves this way. No, the stereo pickup needle in your equipment must be able to move in all directions, because it moves to the right side to get the right channel, moves to the left side to the left channel, and obviously if both channels are played simultaneously, it has to complete freedom to move into every direction. Okay? It follows that you can not play a stereo record with an ordinary monaural pickup. The ordinary monaural pickup, the one-channel pickup, is so built that it can only swing sideways. But if you put such a needle, such a pickup, on a stereo record, it will ruin it, because the stereo record tries to force it to move in all directions to get the two channels reproduced. But the needle cannot do it. So obviously, all the needle, if it's diamond, what it does is to cut and scrape and gouge out your record is ruined. You have to have a stereo pickup to play a stereo recording. But the other way around, if you want to play a monaural recording with a stereo pickup, now that's perfectly fine, because the stereo pickup can move into all directions. But in order to play back a monaural recording, it has only to go back and forth in this direction, you see? Now it can go in all directions, but it doesn't have to in playing a monaural record. So with a stereo pickup, you can play back a monaural recording, of course, as well as stereo recording, but not the other way around. You cannot play a stereo recording with a monaural pickup without ruining your record. Now, there's one more thing I have to say. In addition to pitch and loudness, there is another characteristic which enters into the picture, and this is phase. This is the delay in time which it takes for, say, a sound to reach the ear one way and another way. If you sit in front of an orchestra, then, and here may be the cello play, you have a very, very, very slightly earlier sound effect in your right ear, which is nearer to this the group of cello than with your left ear. Very, very small, but just sufficient to produce the live feeling, the feeling of liveliness. And as a consequence, a stereo recording, you see, this microphone stands in front of the cello, picks up the cello a little earlier than the microphone which stays there. This microphone has, it take a little longer for this microphone which stands at this side of the orchestra to pick up the cello sound, because the cello are on this side. This right microphone picks up the cello 500th of a second maybe earlier than this microphone. But this extremely small time delay is important, and it is reproduced by such stereo recordings, because you have an independent recording of the right channel and of the left channel. Now let me be quite specific. We have a cello sound. The right microphone picks up the cello sound just a little bit earlier, and the consequence it is encoded just a little bit earlier than in the left channel. And if you now sit in front of your stereo equipment, you have the live impression that you hear the cello sound from this side, yeah, and from this side, it comes a little later, you don't know it. But it gives you the feeling of liveliness, which you don't have with a one-hour recording.
Well, in recording stereo, how much do they actually separate the microphones?
Oh, I wouldn't know that. I am not so much interested in a studio, but I am interested in recording a live performance, say, of a large...
Yeah, but your two ears, if you sit in a concert hall, you hear things stereo, and your two ears are just 6 inches apart or something like that. I was wondering if they try to duplicate the things as you would hear them, or whether they pick up different parts of the orchestra and put them together and you still don't know any different.
Well, I'm not an audio engineer by a long shot, but I can only say that the difference between a stereo recording and a mono recording is striking if you have a first class modern stereo recording in which you have this separation. Now, I have several recordings in which it makes no difference. If you have, for instance, one place, let me say this, one place from which the sound originates, you have a singer which has just one mouth, yeah? And it sings right to you, then it makes, in my opinion, not the slightest difference whether you hear him or her monaurally or stereophonically. Even the same is true if you have a small organ. If you have a very large organ, as we have them, where part of the organ is on the right side of the church, the other part on the left side of the church, then of course you lose the stereo effect if you record it monaurally. Now whether this is important or not, that's the question of aesthetic discussion. You say, Bach is so wonderful, I give a hoot whether I hear it, whether the sound comes from the right or from the left. But there are other places where the stereo effect is almost required. Now, for instance, Gabrieli, who was one of the early composers of choral, of antiphonal choral music in Venice, he wrote music specifically for two choirs. He had two brass choirs which were placed on the two ends of this marvelous cathedral. And most certainly, when the worshippers were in the cathedral, they heard blasts of brass from the left side, and then they heard the antiphonal, that is the answering blast from the other side. So there was a very definite, what we now call stereo effect. If such recording of Gabrieli music is made stereophonically, you have again the feeling you are in St. Mark, and the choir, part of the choir is to the left, part of the choir is to the right. This feeling is lost in a one-hour recording. Okay, now I have to to trouble you with one more technical thing, and then I'm through with this discussion. We can have two limiting cases of this phasing, that is, of this time difference. We have one case in which there's no phase difference, in which both sounds originate with exactly the same strength and at the very same moment and are recorded exactly identically in the two channels. Then the right channel pulls you to the right and the left channel pulls to the left, And the effect is that the disc, if you look at it under a microscope, looks like a one-hour recording. The stylus will just move from the left to the right, back and forth. You have no stereo effect, and as a consequence, there is no need for the needle to move in any other direction than in the horizontal direction. The needle moves, the pickup moves exactly the same way as a one-hour pickup. That's one case, one limiting case. And the other limiting case, which to me is quite intriguing, is if you have just one tone, not the number of tones, one tone of exact strength, that is of exact pitch and exact loudness, produced by, say, two sources, two electronic sources maybe, fed to the two microphones, and they go to two speakers. And they are so phased that they are exactly out of phase, then they cancel each other. And theoretically, if you have a stereo headphone, as Carol just said, that Warner gave them, and they are in the music room, that is, you have them, then you wouldn't hear anything. Because the brain, for some strange reasons, there comes a tone from the left and at the same tone offset, 180-degree offset, just canceling the tone from the other side, then the brain doesn't perceive anything. So in this limiting case, but only if you have one tone, see, if you have several tones, you can't do such tricks. In this case, you shouldn't hear anything. And now what would a stereo needle do? The stereo needle, one channel pulls it one way, and the other pulls it the other way, and then the needle, in this case, goes up and down. The needle goes up and down in your groove. It again encodes the information, high tone, frequent wiggling, low tone, slowly going up. If it is a loud tone, it dips very deep. If it's a soft tone, just a little bit. But you wouldn't, in theory, you wouldn't hear anything because the thing is recorded in the vertical direction. And this corresponds to the complete sound cancellation. Now, whether this is true or not, I don't know. I don't think it is exactly true because you have overtones and you have harmonic distortion, all kinds of things. But in theory, it should be true. So these are the two limiting cases. The first case where a stereo recording degenerates, so to speak, to a one-hour recording, if both sounds are exactly properly phased, there's no phase displacement, which makes for the liveliness, but comes at the same time. And as a consequence, then the stylus goes only sideways. And the other case, where the tones are exactly canceling each other, then the stylus goes this way, and in theory, you shouldn't hear anything. I've never tried it, and I think it's very difficult to get such thing. You have to be an audio engineer and have a laboratory with all the equipment, and even then, I think it is formidably difficult to fool around with these things. But in an ordinary stereo recording, the needle can go in any direction, and then you get the stereo effect. Okay, that's all I have to say. Worlds, even 1 hour. I didn't think that I would talk so long. Okay, let's shut that off.
Where does the high fidelity come in as compared with the stereo and the monaural and the movement of the needle?
Oh, high fidelity is just in a commercial term. It doesn't mean anything. The technical terms are monaural, where you have a single channel, and stereo, where you have two channels. High fidelity, hi-fi doesn't mean anything. Usually monaural recordings are trade named hi-fi. You see? Hi-fi means it is only monaural.
Why is it then that you can play high fidelity and stereo with the same needle and the same mechanism, but you cannot play the monaural records onto them?
You can play monaural records on a stereo pickup. You can play a monaural record, that is a hi-fi called, so-called record, on a stereo machine.
Hi-fi, yes, but you can't play the monaural unless you wreck your stylus.
No, it's just the other way around. It's just the other way around. You cannot play a stereo record with an ordinary monaural pickup.
No.
That's it.
Okay.